This is NHPR News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In the midst of all the shivering, shoveling, and polar vortices of this past winter, the optimistic among us found a ray of hope that perhaps the tough weather would be tough on ticks carrying Lyme disease, setting back their rising populations here in New England. But sadly, we're now learning that's not the case. In fact, all the snow we had provided these bugs a nice cozy blanket to rest under till spring. So with New Hampshire already having the nation's highest Lyme disease infection rate, many predict this year may be a doozy for the tick-borne illness. This hour in The Exchange, the latest on Lyme, we'll find out about diagnosis, treatment, and why there's no human vaccine yet for the disease. But let's start at the source, the deer ticks that cause Lyme. And for more on that, Alan Eaton joins us. He's an entomologist at UNH who's studied tick populations for 25 years. And Alan Eaton, welcome back, and thanks a lot for being with us.
Good morning, Laura. Thank you.
So I'm feeling a little bit cheated, Alan. We keep hearing that our warmer winters are making life happy for disease-carrying ticks. Then here we have a serious, old-fashioned winter, lots of snow, lots of cold, and we hear the ticks are still happy. What happened?
Well, of course, the greatest mortality factor for ticks is drying out because they're very flat. They have a tremendous amount of surface area and not much volume. So the snow just seals them in so that they don't dry out. So snow and ice over the top, that did very well. They can handle cold temperatures pretty well.
So it isn't so much about warmth, it's about wet.
It's about drying out or preventing yourself from drying out, exactly.
So how bad is it out there right now, Alan? I heard you're not even going out in the field collecting anymore.
I stopped collecting, at least doing my sampling, because it gets too dangerous about the 15th of May or so, and I moved to other things. And the reason it's getting dangerous is because it's the immatures, the nymphs of, and the correct name, Laura, is black-legged tick.
Not deer tick.
That was a name that's been thrown out almost 20 years ago.
Okay.
And so it's because the nymphs are really active now, and they're even harder to spot than the adults. So it's just too risky for me to do sampling for these. So I do other things at this time of year, like talk on the radio or work on my publications or things like that.
Well, I've heard, Alan, you've had Lyme disease twice yourself now.
Well, I'm at a very high risk job where I'm checking these things a lot. I'm out in the woods a lot, not working or playing, and I've at least had the preliminary symptoms. But I did what I tell people to do when they showed up. I went to my physician right away and got treated. And so there's a series of steps you can do, and some of them are totally preventative, like checking yourself daily for ticks. But once in a while, one gets through your defenses, and if it happens, you react appropriately.
Well, and you mentioned checking yourself, and certainly that's a big, big precaution that we're told about all the time. But the nymphs are pretty small, from what I understand, Alan, so they're pretty hard to find. How big are they?
They're hard to find. They're relatively dark in color, so if you're light-skinned like me, they're fairly easy to spot. A millimeter in length. If you've got a lot of freckles, if you've got really dark skin, then it's going to be harder. But to me, that's no excuse for not trying. We can tremendously reduce the risk by pulling out the ticks that do come in. The one that came in a few minutes ago, here it is an adult female, and she's about 3 millimeters long. And this person looks like pulled it off relatively promptly. And that's what we want to do. We want to remove them, if we can, within 24 hours of their attachment. And if we do that, then the risk of getting Lyme disease from this particular bite is close to zero, because they require, as a nymph, they require 24 hours of biting time to pass on the spirochete. Of course, if they're infected, they've got to be infected too.
Yeah, they have to carry it. Sure.
If it's an adult, they need about 30 hours or longer. So if you can check yourself daily and remove ticks, you are likely in the clear relative to that particular disease, but it's not the only disease.
Which
out
we'll definitely
there.
Talk about for sure later in the hour. Alan, so you're looking at ticks while you're talking to us on the radio, right?
Yeah, I got a couple right here right now.
Well, and I want to let everybody know that our digital producer, Sarah Plour, did a terrific infographic. It's at our website, nhpr.org. It's called Things You Should Know About Ticks, and Sarah put some lovely pictures up there as well. So if you want to look and listen at the same time, go to nhpr.org, Sarah's infographic, Things You Should Know About Ticks. What are some of the biggest changes that you've seen, Alan Eaton, in tick populations in New Hampshire in the quarter century that you've been studying this?
When I first started looking at these 25 years ago, there were a grand total of 3 published records of this particular species in New Hampshire, just 3 records. And part of it was because nobody else was looking for them and publishing the records, but part of it was the numbers were much, much lower. And they've clearly been going up and up and up, so we're finding the geographic spread is a little different, and that's probably because there are some places where they had been before, but they were below detectable levels, but now they're very high levels. An example of this, this last fall when I was checking, I and my workers were checking deer at hunter checking stations, we looked at the a number of individuals of deer that happened to have black-legged ticks on them, and we looked at 150 animals this last fall. 77% of them had at least one black-legged tick on them. The last time I did a major tick study was 1991, and at that point, only 2.4% of the animals had a black-legged tick on them.
So big changes over a short period
there's
of time.
There's an example of one. There's a lot of others, but there's an example of one.
So last question for you, Alan. As spring turns to summer, what needs to happen weather-wise to dial back this Lyme disease threat?
Ticks drying out is their greatest mortality factor. So if we have a drought, if we have a period of a long period when there's warmer temperatures, and in particular, no precipitation, the first thing that will happen after a relatively few days is the tick activity goes down. They drop into the leaf litter or into the soil to try to rehydrate. And then if it stays dry long enough, they start dying. So drought is what really will knock the numbers down tremendously, and that's the biggest factor that affects their activity and behaviors.
Well, Alan Eaton, it's always great to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your interest, Laura.
Alan Eaton, UNH Cooperative Extension entomologist, integrated pest management specialist. He's been studying ticks and Lyme disease in New Hampshire for more than 2 decades. Again, today in The Exchange, we're getting the latest on Lyme, and let's hear from you. Do you have a personal experience with this disease, yourself or someone you care about? Also, if you're a healthcare provider, what are the challenges in treating this? And how well do you see our society addressing this rise in ticks and rise in Lyme disease? The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We have 3 guests for the rest of the hour. David Brooks is here, science reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. He's written several articles recently on ticks and Lyme. And David, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Also with us, Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, associate professor at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth and deputy state epidemiologist for New Hampshire. She's an infectious disease doctor. Dr. Talbot, good to have you. Thank you also.
Thank you.
And also with us, Beth Daly, chief of the Infectious Disease Surveillance Section at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. Beth Daly is an epidemiologist. And Beth, it's good to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, and Beth, I want to start with you. Hearing from Alan Eaton is pretty sobering. From your perspective, what's changed since you've been working in this field?
Well, Lyme disease is an important issue here in New Hampshire. We have seen an increase in Lyme disease since we started tracking it back in the early 90s. Back in the 90s, we had about maybe 20, 40, even 50 cases of the disease reported each year. And then beginning in the year 2000, we did start seeing an increase to about 100, 200 cases. And since then, it's really inclined very rapidly up to about 1,600 cases in 2008. Yeah. Now, I will say there has been some changes in the way we track disease, so we do have to be very careful about the way we interpret our data, but it has really increased over the last 5 to 10 years specifically.
Can you give us just a little more on that, that maybe we're more aware and people are reporting it more, or what are you saying there, Beth?
Well, part of it, we do definitely think there is a true increase in the disease based on a number of factors, movement of tick populations, as Dr. Eaton had mentioned, some of the different host species in New Hampshire, the deer population can play a role in the biology of the tick. And then also, of course, provider recognition as Lyme disease was first as providers were becoming aware of this illness in New Hampshire. Certainly, they're more likely to test for the illness nowadays. There's also been changes in diagnostics that are available as well.
Well, and Dr. Talbot, you know, we've been talking about Lyme disease for quite a while now in this region. But some people say there's still a lot we don't know about Lyme, that it remains mysterious at some level. What don't we know about this? What are we still trying to figure out?
Wow, I think at essentially every level of this disease entity, we are steep on a learning curve. So how do we best prevent it? How do we make changes to our environment and interact with nature in a way that are going to be safe going forward? What are the best agents for prevention of tick bites? How do you recognize disease early as the potential patient? How do we educate our physicians to treat early when the signs are there? And then the unfortunate phenomenon of this infectious disease is that although for the vast majority of people treatment is completely effective, there can be some residua of fatigue and symptoms afterwards. So I think we need to learn how this happens, how we can address it effectively for the suffering patients, and I think on just so many levels, we need to continue to communicate patients to public health, doctors to patients, and throughout the health system. We need to address this problem of persistent symptoms for the patients who suffer with this.
Yeah, what people call chronic Lyme, which we'll definitely talk about a little bit later in the hour. But the prevention, it's interesting. I thought the prevention message was pretty basic. You know, long pants, tuck your socks in, your pants in your socks, don't wear sandals, and so on and so forth. Tick check. I mean, where's the mystery there? Or is there more in prevention that we could do beyond that basic, you know,
well,
long pants and closed-toed
shoes? One thing I
haven't
heard you mention, which I think is an effective trick of the trade, is the use of permethrin, which is a chemical treatment of clothing. So those who are out in the woods who are likely to be exposed in tall grass, they do have this option. This is well known through the military and for international travelers, but it might be something that can be adopted on a more general level.
All right, a little bit of good news on that, perhaps. And we'll talk more in just a moment. David Brooks, I'm going to ask you why there is no human Lyme vaccine. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. The Exchange is coming to the North Country. Join Laura Kanoy and a panel of experts as they discuss the state of the Main Street economies north of the Notches. You can attend this special event at the Colonial Theater in Bethlehem July 10th. Reserve your tickets at nhpr.org. It's made possible with support from the Neil and Louise Tillotson Fund. Cloudy, a chance of showers across New Hampshire today. Cooler, too. Highs only making it into the lower 50s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from the Lucas Community in Temple, serving adults with developmental challenges, now accepting applications for new residents and house parents. Details at lukascommunity.org. And Nathan Wexler and Company, CPAs and business advisors, serving entrepreneurial clients who share a passion for competency, integrity, and community enrichment. Offices in Concord and Lebanon. It's 9:20. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, with tick season in high gear, we're checking out the latest on Lyme disease. And let's hear from you. Call in 1-800-892-6477. If you have personal experience with this disease, tell us about it. If you're a healthcare provider, what are some of the challenges that you face in helping people work through this disease? And how well do you think our society is addressing the rise in ticks that we're seeing? and the rise that comes along with that in Lyme disease. The number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can post a comment there. And David Brooks, you asked the million-dollar question in an article recently in the Telegraph of Nashua, why there is no human vaccine for Lyme. We've got them for dogs, we've got them for cats, but not for us.
Exactly. Well, that's the question I'm always asked every year when I write about Lyme. And a reporter, you try and think of a new angle every year. And so I thought I'd look into that one. And the answer very simplistically is that lawsuits showed up and so the company pulled it. But it's more complicated than that, of course. There was a Lyme vaccine that was developed, came on the market in 98 by SmithKline, I believe, had the name Limerix. Because you got to have an X in your name if you make a drug. And it seemed to work okay, but there was concern about some side effects. It was an annual vaccine, sort of like a flu vaccine. So it's not one you get once and then you're good for life. I had to go back. That was a concern. And reports of side effects, joint pain, inflammation came in. They were never really well established, but there was enough concern, enough lawsuits were filed that SmithKline basically yanked it in 2002.
How much of a clamoring is there now, David, for a Lyme vaccine? Well,
part of the reason I wrote the story is I don't understand why there isn't one. You would think there would be there's this massive market. If you could have any kind of a vaccine, you could sell it on the street corner and make $1 billion. And there is a vaccine being tested at the moment in Germany and Austria that actually was developed in the U.S., Stony Brook and
New York, I think you wrote. Yeah,
Baxter International. And they're testing it in Europe for a variety of regulatory reasons, frankly. And if it does really well, then I suspect there will be a clamor to bring it back over here. And partly because, and you mentioned, of course, the thing that makes it so annoying is that there is a vaccine for our pets. And I asked my veterinarian, who is also my wife, and so she handed me all these papers I had to read all night, about why that is and how it works. And there are actually two vaccines for your pets, the two different kinds, and I'm sure I'll get the terminology slightly wrong. There's OSP-A and OSP-C, and OSP-A goes actually inside the tick and attacks the bacteria inside the tick before it gets injected into the dog. There are fewer complications, but there's concern that it might miss some of the bacteria, and so some of it will still get into the dog. And then OSP-C basically mimics what happens in nature, and it creates the antibodies inside the dog so it can attack bacteria that makes it into it. The vaccine Limerix was like OSP-A. It actually went into the tick and attacked it, which is more complicated. These vaccines have an effectiveness that is for your pets. 60 to 90% is the numbers in the literature.
Okay, so not perfect.
Not even close to perfect. It's much more complicated in animals. So, for example, you want to bring up cats. You can get a whole bunch of veterinarians arguing frantically about that. In fact, because there's questions of whether cats even get Lyme disease. And the general consensus in the veterinary community at the moment is they don't. And actually, there's a terminology thing here that I always stumble over as a layman as to what it means to get Lyme, because you can be exposed to the bacteria.
But not get it.
But not have any symptoms or signs. So the question is, do you have Lyme if there's antigens and bacteria floating in your bloodstream, but you're fine?
All right. Well, maybe a little bit more on the vaccine in just a moment. But I do want to bring Dr. Talbot into this. You must get this question from your patients, Dr. Talbot. You know, for those of us who love to be outdoors, and then we hear from Alan Eaton that the nymphs are, you know, teeny, teeny, tiny. It's maddening that we can vaccinate our pets and not ourselves.
Yeah, it's true, of course. And the prevention message is, frankly, not very sexy. You know, as you said, you ran through it very quickly and very efficiently.
Long pants, closed-toed shoes. Meanwhile, it's 100 degrees. I mean, you know, who wants to put on long pants and long sleeves and closed-toed shoes?
No, of course, especially when we live in such a beautiful state. We want to be out and about. But again, I do think that there are the methods, as you described, and then permethrin can take take it to a second level to keep us safe outside.
Yeah, and just remind us what that is.
Sure.
Is that a spray or an oil?
It comes in a lot of different forms, and frankly, you just need to follow the directions that are on the bottle that you purchase. But any of the outdoor companies like EMS or REI, but also the pharmacies now carry it, hardware stores will have it as well. There are also smart ways to configure your landscaping. I'm looking to Beth now because I know she knows a lot about that. So maybe can I ask her to fill that in?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But one more question about this spray or oil or lotion or whatever it may be. Do you put it on your skin like you mosquito spray, or do you spray it on your socks or your shoes or what?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for that clarification. No, it's for materials. So you can put it to your socks or your long pants or
which I'm not going to wear when it's 100 degrees. Right?
But also your tent if you're out camping. And depending on which formulation you buy, it can last for up to 20 washes. So it's something that binds to the fibers but does not affect you on your skin at all.
I see.
Yeah.
Is there anything like mosquito spray that you can put on your feet and ankles, you know, when you're out with your sandals and shorts on?
Yeah, I think the DEET is effective, and picaridin has also been used as a tick repellent.
Okay, great. And Beth Daly, real interesting what Dr. Talbot says. It turns out, and you've been looking at this, that there are ways that we manage our landscapes, our backyards, our parks or whatever, that encourage tick populations, and there are ways to manage these landscapes that discourage tick populations.
That's right. So I think the personal protection measures are so important, and along with the daily tick checks. But there are other things that we can be doing. Specifically, homeowners can look at the way that they're landscaping their yards to create tick-safe zones. This would include creating a barrier if you live up against the woods. Between the woods and the lawn, you want it to be at least 3 feet wide. And you could use a mulch or gravel or rocks to prevent the ticks from moving from the woods and brushy areas into your lawn. You can also put similar barriers around your patio or around a playground or play equipment to prevent the ticks from coming into the areas where your family would most be. Of course, you also want to keep your grass short and remove leaf litter because, as Dr. Eaton mentioned, those are areas that the ticks will like to be. You also want to keep mice and bird populations away from your house. And then there is this final option where you could have a company come in and apply a chemical insecticide to your lawn to control the tick population.
But then you're killing good bugs along with bad, right?
Well, they're acaricides, so they're targeted for these hard ticks.
I see.
Yep, and this is a very active area of research, actually, because they're curious. They want to actually show that these types of interventions do actually reduce Lyme disease from a human health perspective. So we know that these types of activities will reduce the tick populations in your yard. So theoretically, they'll reduce your risk of Lyme disease, but they have prevention trials that are looking at exactly that question.
So you mentioned mice and birds. Now, I have heard about these black-legged ticks being carried by, I think it's white-footed mice. Do I have that right, Beth? But I thought birds ate ticks, so they were helping us in terms of this.
Well, the mice are the primary reservoir for the Borrelia bacteria. That's when the tick attaches to the mouse, that's where they're first picking up the Borrelia infection. But birds can also play a role as a reservoir as well, where the small nymphs can attach to the birds, and then the birds can help with dispersal of those ticks across your property.
I see. Okay, David Brooks, to you and then to our listeners. Lots of people want to jump in our conversation.
Talking about landscaping, one of the most interesting things I wrote about in recent years was at the Complex Systems Research Center UNH does. They have something called eco-epidemiology. There's that word again.
Eco-epidemiology.
Which is correlating the ecology with diseases. And they were specifically looking at whether they could actually take satellite pictures of landscape and forest cover and measurements of soil moisture. And the dream was to create a sort of like you had a pollen count. So, you know, today's going to be a bad pollen day, is they'd have a tick count. In this part of, you know, Hillsborough County today, tick counts will be high because the soil moisture is high. I don't believe it's quite gotten that far, but that's one of the things they're looking at, and that's exactly related to landscaping and keeping the ticks away from us and keeping us away from the ticks.
Wow, that's interesting. So just like we have sort of smog alerts or ozone alerts and, as you said, pollen alerts, we would have tick alerts?
Well,
I think
that's sort of a dream, but that was the goal they were kind of aiming at. You know, today's going to be a very high tick day. Don't go outside without your long pants on.
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later, what that might do to sort of public paranoia. But let's go to our listeners. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can find us on Twitter, too. Let's go to Courtney in Contoocook first. Hi, Courtney. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for having this program today. I really wanted to call in and say hello.
Go ahead, Courtney. Yeah.
Okay, so I moved back to New Hampshire about a year ago, and within about a month, I moved back in the spring. I got very sick, and I thought I had the flu. And I went to the doctor, and she sent me home. And I went to the ER 10 days later, and they sent me home. They thought I had meningitis. And I finally ended up in the ER again.
Wow.
And they finally did an EKG on me and found that I had Lyme carditis, which is a pretty serious complication of Lyme.
On your heart, right, Courtney? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's when it gets in the heart. So I was having heart palpitations. And I broke out in a rash all over my body. And one of the problems with Lyme is that it affects your brain. So I was so sick that I wasn't able to advocate for myself properly, if you know what I mean. And it took so long to get diagnosed. And I was shocked when they told me that it would take a whole year for me to recover. And that's definitely been true. And
how are you doing now,
it's
Courtney?
It's a hard lesson to learn.
Yeah, how are you doing now?
I'm doing well. I'm managing it. I'm doing the dieting, and I'm doing the exercising, and I'm still on medication, and I'm managing it. But it's been really difficult. And, we moved here because I really wanted my son to be able to play in the woods and play outside. And I don't want him to I don't want to let him out of the house now.
Yeah, that's tough. Courtney, thank you so much for calling in. A couple things to pull out from here, folks. And Dr. Talbot, to you first, Lyme is still, I don't want to say underdiagnosed, but it's tough to diagnose. I've heard other stories like Courtney's.
I'm sorry to hear your story, Courtney. That does sound very, terrible. You know, and your situation is probably a little atypical. You know, again, I want to reassure folks that in general, symptoms are recognizable by their clinicians. This bullseye rash, and often associated with the knowledge of having had a tick, that should lead you to seek medical attention immediately so that you can get treated early. So your situation is unusual also for the fact that you had a manifestation, a disease of dissemination. So the bacteria had gotten out and about into your body in a terrible way. Carditis is a known phenomenon. It's extremely rare, but very serious. So, again, sorry for your experience. And I appreciate your interest in looking to protect your family from what you've been through, and I do think there are methods to do so.
Well, I want to ask you about the testing. How accurate is it, Dr. Talbot? I mean, because I've heard that it isn't always accurate. It doesn't catch everything, that it catches, 70% or 80%, which still leaves a big chunk of people having Lyme and not knowing it. So how accurate are those tests?
Thanks for that question. It is difficult to understand exactly how these tests function because of the different stages of disease. So in early disease, the two-tiered testing methods that is used is not perfectly sensitive, and we depend on our clinicians to recognize the signs of disease. So we do have a strong education campaign for clinicians to treat early when a patient appears consistent with Lyme, even if the test is not done, or even if the test is negative in those early stages. Later in disease, the testing algorithm works well, and it involves two tests. The first test is the ELISA, which casts a very broad net. It is more likely to give false positives, and therefore is followed by what's called the Western blot when it's equivocal or positive, and that confirms disease. So we're not used to having a testing method that requires two different kinds of tests, and it has led to a lot of confusion. I think out of that confusion, there's arisen tests that are not FDA approved and that are not validated and done by labs that are not CLIA certified, and this concerns me a great deal.
Yeah, I remember once at some point somebody said, I was tested for Lyme, and someone said, you need to get a test from California because the ones that they do here, they're not good. So there is this sort of other market for testing. I'm really interested in what Courtney said to Beth Daly about her son. She says, we moved here so he could grow up playing outside and being in the woods. And, a lot of people in New Hampshire want that for their kids. And now she's like, she doesn't even want to send him outside.
Well, we certainly don't want people to be paralyzed by fear. As Dr. Talbot mentioned, people should be getting outside and enjoying our beautiful state and getting exercise and all these other benefits that being outdoors offers us. It's just important to do your best at following the prevention methods that are available to us now and then being on the lookout for any potential symptoms. And as your caller mentioned, advocating for your own health.
Yeah, it's tough. I have read stories, David Brooks, about people who reach this level of illness that Courtney was at, where they're so tired, they're so depressed, they feel confused that they can't make that case for themselves. They can't wade through this whole medical system.
Absolutely. And that's one of the issues with Lyme is that it's either changing or our understanding about it is changing so much that it's really hard for the layman to keep up with it. And so you end up going to the website, and I went on the web today, and I found a web that said, absolutely, the test never, ever has false positives, but it always has false negatives, i.e. there's a lot more Lyme than we thought. And so when there's ignorance and uncertainty, you know, it's easy for conspiracy theories to wander in. I got to say, I have already pulled two attached ticks off myself this year.
Were they the little teeny nymphs, or were they grown-up ticks?
Well, by the time I got to them, I mean, they were big enough for me to grab. They were pretty small, but they were very small, so it was, you know, it's not like they were the old dog ticks that I'm used to. And neither of them turned into a, you know, looking like the Target logo. And but if I'd suddenly came down with the flu tomorrow, I'd go to the doctor. Well, I wouldn't know, but I'd be worried about it. I'd go and get it. So, but
you said
the
Target logo, that's the bullseye.
The bullseye, sorry, the bullseye, yeah, exactly. I'm not going to sit inside and watch YouTube videos all day just because I'm scared of ticks.
Let's go to another caller. Courtney, good luck, and thank you for calling. And Barbara's up next from Gosstown. Hi, Barbara, you're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, I'd like to just make a couple statements. I'm have a cold, and I don't want to talk a long time. I got bitten last July, and I started on doxycycline. And
that's an antibiotic, right, Barbara?
Pardon me?
That's an antibiotic, right?
Right,
yep.
Right. And when I went in August, I asked the druggist how much it cost, and he told me, well, last month it was $20. This month it's $260. And now it's $1,600 for a month's supply. I just want to make that statement. And doxycycline is an old drug. It's not anything new, so it shouldn't have to go up that high. I want to tell you that I had to wait 6 months to get a Lyme literate doctor that knew what they were doing. The waiting list was 6 months long. When I talk to people, I tell everybody now I have Lyme. People say that they know two or three others, and I didn't think that there's been enough knowledge told to the people, and my guess, I don't know, is that it has to do with the economy and the tourists won't come. But there's not enough information.
Yeah, Barbara, there's lots to talk about. Thank you for calling in. Very quickly, Beth Daly, public information, getting the word out there to folks. That's DHHS.
Sure. Public education is a priority for us. Of course, being a public health department, our role is really along the prevention lines. We do try to push information out to a number of different audiences. We issue an annual press release. We're happy to talk to the media as much as we can, and also distributing materials out to rest areas. So they're right there in the visitor center about the high risk of Lyme disease in New Hampshire, as well as schools and getting at that child population.
All right. Well, Barbara, good luck to you. Thank you for calling in. We'll be right back with more conversation about Lyme disease. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning. It's 9:39.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the value of a college degree and whether it's worth the debt. Then our May readers review The Secret History by Donna Tartt. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Cloudy, some showers for today. Cooler temperatures, highs only in the lower 50s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners. Sam from Antioch University, New England's master and doctorate degrees in environmental studies, preparing you for a career making a difference in today's world. AntiochNE.edu. And Vineyard Brands Importers of Marcus de Caceres wines from the Rioja region of northern Spain. Information on the web at vineyardbrands.com. It is 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we talk with the guru of New England's power grid about increasing challenges of keeping the region's electricity demands satisfied. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. Today in The Exchange, a closer look at Lyme disease in New England and New Hampshire. Join us with your thoughts, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can also find us on Twitter. Our guests are David Brooks, science reporter for The Telegraph of Nashua, Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, associate professor at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth, and Beth Daly, chief of the Infectious Disease Surveillance Section at New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. Again, the exchange number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. And let's go next, all of you, to Jason and Raymond. Jason, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Great topic. This has been, in my 37 years of life, the worst experience I've had this year thus far with chicks. My question for you guys is, what is the best treatment or prevention for my dog? This year, I lost track at the end of March of how many chicks I've already pulled off of him.
For your dog, you're saying, Jason?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not worried about yourself?
I can look at myself pretty well. You know, when I'm out working in the yard, I got 2.5 acres on the Lambre River. So, yeah, I'm very green. So, yeah, I watch myself. But the dog is, you know, it's you kind of forget sometimes. The dog's been out with you all day, too. You forget, you know, sometimes you got to check him out, too. And like I said, I've lost count this
sure,
year.
Sure, sure.
And as a kid with my childhood dog, I don't remember having this much trouble.
We've heard that it's changed a lot. And David Brooks, this is a little unfair, but you did say your wife is a veterinarian. I know you've talked about this. So real quick, please.
Real quick. If I get this wrong, I'm in trouble. Basically, as long as your dog is vaccinated, you're probably in pretty good – you are in pretty good shape. Dogs do not show symptoms and signs of Lyme anywhere near like humans do. It's very host specific. So – the fact that there's a lot of ticks on your dog and the fact that the ticks probably are carrying the bacteria is not necessarily mean that your dog is going to get sick and start having joint pain and all that.
Although the dog could be bringing the ticks into the house.
Now, that's an excellent point. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Beth, go ahead.
I was exactly going to make that point. The prevention of getting ticks on your pets is also very important because your pets can carry the tick into your home, and then the tick can then get on your bedding or depending on where you let your pets roam in your house and then attach to you and be a risk for Lyme disease for you. There are commercially available products that you can apply to your pet. It usually includes fipronil or a chemical insecticide that will prevent the ticks from attaching to the pet, but they don't necessarily prevent the ticks from getting on your pet. So it is really important to, you know, feel your animal, especially dogs, quite a bit when they come into the house to try and find any ticks on them as well. It can be very hard, of course, with their furry coat, but you want to remove the ticks if you find them.
Okay, and I'm giving Beth a horrified look because I'm thinking about my two cats, and they're a little harder to work with. So you're saying the ticks aren't attached to them per se, you know, sucking into their skin, but they could be on the cats and they could be getting ticks, you know, who knows where, on the couch, whatever.
Exactly.
Okay. Jason, thanks for calling in. We had not talked about pets bringing them into the house and so forth. Thank you for the call. Good luck. And let's go next to Carissa in Wolfboro. Hi, Carissa. Thanks for being with us. You're on the air.
Howdy. How are you?
Good.
All right. I've had Lyme for 7 years, 2.5 diagnosed, so it's definitely the acute form. And people often say, and I think it would help with acknowledgement of the damage of the disease, would to stop saying, I had, it would help. And I wanted to also have a question to the doctor that spoke earlier. He's been, sorry, I talk funny because I have babesia in my brain as well. He said he was working for 26 years with Lyme. I wanted to know if there's any reported human antibodies built to the disease to date and who would be working with it.
Yeah, and if you're referring to Alan Eaton, he's not with us anymore. Oh. He just joined us for the top of the show. But we do have Dr. Talbot with us. And, Carissa, I'm so sorry to hear about your experience. You know, this brings up the issue, Dr. Talbot, of what people call chronic Lyme. She says, don't say I had Lyme. Some people still have Lyme. Can you just clarify that for us, please?
Certainly that people can have Lyme disease. They can get appropriately treated. and they can be done with that disease. Certainly, it's a terrible disease also for the fact you can become reinfected. It seems it's not once in a lifetime, unfortunately. But the issue of persistence is one we are all trying to learn very much about.
So the symptoms don't go away.
Yeah. So in longitudinal studies, studies where they take well-confirmed Lyme disease patients by standard testing methods, and they follow them out, as said, probably 10 to 20% of those folks don't get immediately back to their baseline, and symptoms can last up to 6 months or more. So obviously I can't know your whole story, Carissa, and I'm sorry for your what sounds like an awful experience and also an unusual experience with Lyme, that you're still struggling with this. But we are very much trying to learn about the issue of persistence with Lyme disease.
And doctors, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Talbot, they don't call it chronic Lyme. They call it the idea that the Lyme disease makes you more susceptible to other problems, or how do they explain this issue of what some call chronic Lyme, the idea that you still don't feel good?
Post-treatment Lyme disease symptoms.
That's what I'm looking
syndrome.
For.
Yeah.
Right.
So, again, this recognizes that people after appropriate treatment sometimes have a constellation of symptoms such as fatigue, maybe headache, subtle neurologic disease. But there is no evidence that I've seen convincing me that there are living bacteria in such a patient, and there are good studies that reassure me that risk-benefit doesn't favor the use of chronic antibiotics.
Long-term antibiotic
use,
more problems than perhaps help. Is that what you're saying?
Sure. There's risks involved with putting in a long-term intravenous access, and antibiotics themselves can lend to side effects and unintended consequences. So we're trying to learn how best to address it. Clearly, there should be an approach of communication with your primary care doc or provider, and consideration of supportive methods. I also am concerned that sometimes people are so convinced from reading lots of sources on the internet or so that they have this syndrome that they avoid seeking an alternate diagnosis. So that's a tragedy to me when that line of communication is no longer open and they don't have access to diagnostics for the other diseases that may be causing their trouble.
Carissa, thanks for the call. Did you want to jump in, David Brooks?
Yeah. Part of the issue is that it's not clear how many of us can be infected without being sick. And I talked briefly about dogs, obviously. The pet world I know more of. And because dogs are blood samples are routinely tested for Lyme disease, there's a very good knowledge of how many dogs out there have actually show signs of having been infected, and it's huge, and most of them aren't sick. And so the question is that true for people? So, for example, maybe I got bitten by Lyme-infected ticks, and my body squashed it, and I was fine. I never got sick, and now I have the antibodies, and if I was tested for Lyme, quote unquote, I would have Lyme. And so
but
if something else
and
it, but if something else came along, they'd say, "Oh, you have a headache. But look, I tested you for Lyme. It must be Lyme."
Even though it could be another
thing.
Even though
it could be another thing. And that's a complication. And I'm not quite sure. Maybe Lyme is getting dangerous enough that we need to start making it, I don't know, a reportable disease or something that or tests for blood all the time, so we have a sense as to how much of an issue this is.
I feel like often these days when I go into the doctor for one problem or another, they do test me for Lyme. It does seem to be becoming more standard. Like, you know, since you're here, Laura, let's test you for Lyme. I don't know if you've had that experience, David. No. Beth Daly, go ahead, jump in. David was talking about the reporting and how
well,
we do that.
Well, Lyme disease is reportable in New Hampshire, which is how we share the data. Of course, it's a very common illness, the second most reportable disease to our department. But, you know, we don't like to focus too much on the numbers because we know that there's under recognition of the disease. And CDC recently released a report saying that for every case that's reported to us, the 1,700 that reported last year, there's 10 times as many cases that are actually occurring. So
wow.
Whether it's 1,500 or 1,600, the point is that it's a significant issue in New Hampshire.
Here's an email that I want to throw at you, Beth. This is from Beth in Canterbury. She says, "I've had many embedded ticks Often I remove the tick. The site turns red, swells, expands, sometimes for many inches. The site feels warm to the touch and is itchy. This can continue for months and reoccur for a year, more or less, even though I treat it immediately with doxycycline. Beth says this is not Lyme disease. I've been tested many times. Please tell us about some of the other impacts and diseases of tick contacts and what should be done to reduce reactions like this. There's a lot in this email, but what I want to focus in on with you, Beth, and maybe the others, is that Lyme disease isn't the only thing we need to worry about with ticks. There's other diseases out there as well.
That's correct. There are other diseases that ticks, these particular black-legged ticks, can transmit to humans. In New Hampshire, those are Babesia, which is a parasite, and then also Anaplasma, which is a bacteria that causes a similar illness to Lyme disease in terms of the fatigue and such, but it doesn't cause that bullseye rash. And so I'm not sure we're going to exactly answer the question. Maybe Dr. Tabbitt will jump in on that. There are certainly other diseases that we're watching, and we have seen increases. Babesia became reportable in New Hampshire in 2005. We used to see maybe one or two, three cases a year. And just even in the last 5 years, last year we had 22 cases reported. And for Anaplasma, similarly, we used to see one cases per year. And last year we had 88 cases reported. So they are increasing, certainly not to the degree that Lyme disease has exploded here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Talbot.
We've also seen a case of Powassan virus. So indeed, there is more than one reason to avoid being bit by ticks, by being bit by insects. And some people are sensitive to the saliva, to the mouth parts of ticks, and there can be even just plain old allergic reactions, hypersensitivity reactions.
Yeah, like our emailer has, yeah.
Yeah. So we emphasize that prevention methods. I guess, again, it's not very sexy, but you can hear that there's many reasons to try to do so and to make the eco-epidemiologic choices, as David mentioned.
All right. Well, thanks for the email, Beth. Good luck to you. And let's go next to Portsmouth, where Tom is waiting. Hi, Tom. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Wow. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Great. Welcome.
I'm a degreed entomologist. I've done pest control in the Hampshire area for about 25 years now. And there's a couple of things maybe that will help the listeners. If you cut your lawn 2 inches, it's going to be too dry for the ticks to live, so you don't have to worry about going out on your lawn to get a tick. And then also pushing the leaf litter back away from the edges of your lawn, it's going to also decrease your chances of running into them. So just to throw in a thing, excuse me, something for the pest control industry, we're here to help. So there's plenty of companies that you can also talk to that get a little help for activities in the backyard.
How much, I know Beth Daly talked about this earlier, but I'll ask you, Tom, how much do these pest controls, insecticides or whatever you want to call them, how much do they hurt other creatures in the ecosystem, worms, other bugs, birds?
Well, most of what the industry uses now is pyrethroids, which are relatively safe for the environment. They break down into natural elements after a couple weeks. And they're going to only affect the areas where we're applying them. So it's not going to be like the old days. I know people ask all the time. But this is very specific to the spots we're putting it, and then it's going to break down and not be harmful in the environment afterwards.
So the water quality or anything like that. We're not going to be drinking this in our groundwater, you know,
No, you're not going to have any problems like that anymore. It's just mostly targeting the areas where we're going to be treating and being effective in those areas, and you're not going to have any problems if they're applied properly, with secondary situations like the old days where to get into the water supply or anything like that. We just don't have chemicals that are that strong anymore.
Tom, thanks a lot for jumping in on the conversation. Good information. And all of you, we just have a couple minutes left. And Beth Daly, what's the big message that you want to send to people listening today? I have to say, you know, you and others have been saying, get out, enjoy. And then there's all these terrible diseases that these disgusting little bugs carry.
Well, I think the primary message today is around the prevention messages that we've already discussed. One item that we did not discuss that I wanted to share with you is some of the data we've collected on the prevalence of Borrelia in the tick population in New Hampshire. We have conducted some studies on this and showing that the prevalence is very high. 60% of New Hampshire ticks are infected with this bacteria.
Carrying That's the bacteria that causes Lyme disease.
Yes. Now, of course, as we've talked about, the tick needs to be attached for at least 36 hours to transmit the disease. And so there is one other option available to people that we haven't talked about, which is if you do find a deer tick on your body that is engorged and you believe has been attached for more than 36 hours, you can consult with your physician to decide if a prophylactic dose of a single dose of doxycycline might be appropriate for you, which could prevent you from developing Lyme disease. Of course, we don't want everyone to be going out there and taking antibiotics if not appropriate. So it's a discussion that needs to happen with your physician. But if you have a very compelling bite where you actually pulled off an engorged tick that you believe was there for at least 36 hours and is a deer tick, then that is one additional prevention option available to you.
And again, to see what some of these ticks look like, because it does have to be the deer tick. I'm sorry, not the deer tick, the black-legged tick. That's what
Correct.
Alan Eaton told us. You can go to our website, nhpr.org. Our digital producer, Sarah Plourd, has put up some great information. It's an infographic called Things You Should Know About Ticks. So that's good to hear, Beth. A little prophylactic antibiotic use might save you a lot of heartache down the road.
And that is a potential recommendation just because the Borrelia prevalence in our tick population is so high in New Hampshire.
Yeah. Final thoughts from you, Dr. Talbot.
Well, I want to come back to the message that most people with this disease will get treated and will get better. So I think that the fear that surrounds this disease in a large part is unwarranted and that yes, people do suffer with it immensely, but most people will do okay. And the key is to communicate with your clinician, your provider, I think to get the care that you need and to let them know if you don't respond to treatment as predicted. So communicate and prevent.
Yeah, and David, what are you going to be communicating with your readers as this tick season hits high gear?
I think part of the issue is that most people think ticks are really gross. And I've seen your expression on your face a couple during the show. You obviously agree with that. And actually, ticks are really cool. They're very interesting animals like spiders. So you should enjoy interacting with nature in this case. And
I'll respectfully disagree with you there, David. But again, if you want to see pictures of the ticks, you can go to our website, nhpr.org. It's good to see all of you. Thank you for being here. David Brooks, thanks a lot for your time. We appreciate it.
You bet.
David Brooks, science reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. Dr. Talbot, good to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, associate professor at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth and an infectious disease doctor. And Beth Daly, thanks for all the information. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Beth Daly, chief of the Infectious Disease Surveillance Section at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Alan Cohen. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, the guru of our region's power grid. As head of ISO New England, Gordon Van Wiley oversees supply and demand for electricity throughout the region, and with that comes the challenges of shifting energy markets, rising electricity costs, and accommodating new alternative sources. We'll talk with him about that and predictions for demand this summer. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and Dartmouth Hitchcock, primary care doctors and nurses who put you at the center of health. 13 locations statewide. Information at d-hdocs.org. And Capital Center for the Arts in Concord, presenting Melissa Etheridge, This Is Me Solo, playing acoustic and electric guitar, harmonica, and piano, June 8th at 7:30. Tickets at ccanh.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Millions of new college graduates will be looking for work this summer. The latest data indicate their degrees are worth the increasingly high cost of tuition, room, and board. Americans with four-year college degrees last year earned 90%.